The Crude Life, the most trusted voice in energy.
There's a lot of people running their mouth that don't stay the night, never come through town. And some other people running about that don't take the time to suss you out. Still some of us every night we make a toast to you, like isn't it nice that somebody had the presence of mind to speak up for you. Let there be light.
Welcome to the Crude Life Week in Review. My name is Jason Spiess. Thank you folks for joining us this week. We have a fabulous show in store for you. Busy week here at the Crude Life. Coming up in just a moment, an update from the Marcellus Utica Appalachian Shale Play with Joe Sinnott of Whiting Partners. Also, our social media spotlight this week is from Maui. Football picks with the unicorn lawyer Sarah Stogner. Industry expert interview with Curtis Junt, a pipeline engineer. Ethical energy with Edwin Hahn, plus much, much more on today's episode of The Crude Life. Folks, stick around. You're not going to want to miss today's episode. Let's head to the Marcellus Utica Appalachian Shale Play with Joe Sinnott.
Due diligence and the shifts of energy happen. What can you bring to an organization to help them guide through the following year?
Well, I said it before, Jason. I can give them the ability to think more clearly and more consciously than they're currently doing. I have not encountered an organization where leaders are not struggling to get out of their own way, to slow down, to push off the busyness, if you will, that can be pushed off, whether they believe it or not, but to, you know, to push aside the things that are not connected to the mission and that are hindering their ability to get their job done. My blend of coaching, my approach to coaching, allows individuals to do just that, to think more clearly and, more importantly, to think more tactically. So, for instance, Jason, again, instead of just telling you and companies and having a commercial of, you know, again, what I do and how I approach things, and, you know, I'll take a page from Deion Sanders, right? You know, instead of talking about culture and all of those things, I'll tell you about how I achieve wins with people. It's working with individual leaders who have some challenge in front of them. And in many cases, it's communicating upwards to their superiors, or it's, you know, motivating their employees who are looking at other jobs, who are disgruntled, who aren't happy with the direction of the company. When I sit down with an individual one-on-one, we come up with a plan that's catered to them, and it's actionable, and I can hold them accountable, and I can work from an asynchronous standpoint and help them put together outlines and questions and talking points that are very specific to their audience in a way that no other consultant or coach is quite frankly able to do, Jason. So it's being that resource, being in their back pocket, so to speak, to address targeted needs, come up with specific solutions, and not have to rely on them piecing together, again, generic leadership stuff, generic tools, tips, tricks, listening to all kinds of podcasts, reading books, sitting through all day leadership trainings and everything else, which again are all valuable, but I'm able to do it in a targeted, efficient way, which is, you know, certainly consistent with a lot of the goals of our industry, so that those leaders can go and execute, achieve results, and also do it with the confidence that they have somebody in me that they can trust, that's independent, that quite frankly, they can have conversations with that they can't have with anybody else. But again, this isn't just therapy. This isn't just having them talk through things. It's also, like I said multiple times already, coming up with a plan and executing upon that plan and generating results, generating the wins, if you will, that Deion Sanders is hyper focused on. So that's my blend of coaching. Maybe it's I don't want any sort of, you know, I don't want to get sued by Deion Sanders, but, you know, maybe there's an element of the, you know, the Deion Sanders coaching model, if you will. It's hyper focused on wins and coming up with a playbook, if you will, and an approach that is focused on results and not just talk, not just words, but actions.
Well, that's one of the things that I really enjoy about our conversations, because you have an oil and gas background. And then on top of that, you have a volunteer or community outreach, not only in your local community through your wife and your children, but also through, is it the Society of Petroleum Engineers that you're a part of? Which one are you always a moderator or something to do with the speaking roles, that sort of thing out there?
Yeah, that's the one. So yeah, SBE, you know, member of lots of different industry organizations out there. And, you know, again, very happy to advocate for our industry and weave together a lot of the themes that we talk about, Jason. But mm-hmm. I think the one you're referring to, yeah, is the Society of Petroleum Engineers. I'm one of the moderators of their tech talk. So on average, I think 2 times a week, they have an SPE tech talk where a company comes on, talks about some new technology, some new approach. And I've had the good privilege of moderating those conversations, which is great. And, you know, it's a great way to leverage my independence, which is nice. And certainly the folks at SPE like the fact that I can come in as an independent resource and poke around and challenge and ask good questions. But at the end of the day, also have an enjoyable conversation. Quite frankly, it sort of checks the box on my tug back to my former role as a technical leader. So selfishly, I enjoyed keeping up on new technology. But yeah, you're referring to some LinkedIn Live conversations that I have a couple times a month for SPE, Jason.
Well, I'm also referring to the fact that you do poaching outside of the oil and gas industry, but we've been primarily talking about that because, of course, with the crude life and some of the other primary energy work that we both have done in the past, it makes sense for us to have that conversation. But at the same time, you do other coaching outside of the oil and gas industry. But for those in the oil and gas industry, the other part I enjoy about not only the outreach and the being able to connect with people outside of the industry is you really have a front row seat to some of the latest innovation happening because of this community outreach that you do within the industry. What's happening with some of the innovation, I guess, because that is something you and I don't talk much about. And I feel like it's been a disservice because your mind has very much been collecting a lot of information on the new innovations happening in the industry. So do you have an update for us on something like that? Pop quiz.
I think sort of the generic observations of, again, this is Joe Sinnott's observations, but a lot of the innovation is centered on, focused on the, whatever you want to call it, decarbonization or, lower carbon technologies. You know, you're not going to find any major company out there, whether it's on the operator side or on the service side, you're not going to find any company that doesn't have some sort of low carbon angle. And so that's where a lot of the energy is focused, at least publicly, Jason. But what's nice that I get to see, both from, again, the world of SPE and also in my day-to-day working with a diverse mix of clients, is that, you know, these companies are still focused on getting more efficient on the ho-hum activities, if you will, not to call, horizontal, drilling and unconventional completions ho-hum by any stretch of the imagination. Again, I say that as somebody who's been a part of that and was privileged to witness that evolution. But, you know, companies are still focused on finding those not just incremental changes, but step changes in drilling completions, how to produce these wells. And again, it's not as sexy as the newer stuff, as the greener stuff, but it's worth noting that, you know, there's no companies out there, Jason, that are resting on their laurels, right? There's, or again, if they are, they're not going to be around for long, or they're not going to continue to attract the talent that's out there, because people want to be a part of, you know, new things, challenging the status quo, trying new things, you know, maintaining a science budget, if you will, an R&D budget internally. So again, I'm lucky enough to see sort of behind the curtain in a lot of companies, and can happily report that the innovations that are out there aren't just painted green, if you will. We're still working towards efficiencies on the most basic elements of, you know, oil and gas extraction.
And that was Joe Sinnott of Whiting Partners. To listen to the full-length interview or to check out other exclusive interviews, visit thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. Up next, we head over to Maui, get an update with what's happening with their energy and infrastructure. My name is Jason Spies, and this is The Crude Life We Can Review.
Doesn't get no fire, doesn't get no sewer, life, 5,000 candles.
The Crude Life, the most trusted voice in energy.
You always stood in front of me, always keeping me behind the scenes, and there's nothing that you don't know.
Welcome back to the Crude Life Week in Review. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us today. We're going to head over to Maui next and get an update from our social media spotlight.
Lived in Wahikuli on Wahikuli Road. I was a server at Kimo's on Front Street, which is like one of the first born TS restaurants. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Slater Fleck. I actually live in Shark Pit, and my house was also destroyed as well, so I went to go to the gym I go to at 7, and it was closed because there was power outage, and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to go start the day elsewhere, do something different. And I actually ended up just kind of being with Sierra the whole day.
It was actually one of our friends' 21st birthdays, and we had been sitting at Duke's. The power had been out, so it was hard to get a table, and then we ended up just going back to my house in Wahikuli and playing Scrabble with my mom. And then I got a call from my brother Ola, and he was like, hey, have you guys seen this fire yet? We weren't really concerned about the fire reaching our house because I guess we thought it was a little more under control than it was. We definitely should have thought otherwise, though, with the way the winds were blowing. We decided to leave the house just for the evening just because we were worried about smoke coming in our way. I luckily grabbed my laptop, a book I was reading, and a toothbrush. She grabbed all 6 of her chickens and her dog. And we just stayed up north for the night. And my brother-in-law, Kimo Clark, he's the owner of Truex. He had been fighting the fires up at Lahaina Luna. He had called us and was like, yeah, I think you guys should go stay elsewhere just because of the way the wind is shifting. And he had been fighting the fires all night. And he came back to the place where we were staying up north that night at like 12 o'clock and just like told us that like, the fire just got so out of control that all of our houses were gone. And, like, the whole neighborhood is most likely going to be gone, too.
It was kind of surreal because I had only the clothes on my back, and I didn't realize that my house was going to burn. I didn't think it was going to start going that way. But, you know, it's hard because you don't realize what you've lost until you've lost it. And it's honestly such a humbling thing when you lose everything you have.
What happened after the fire and what people did, what the government did, how everyone came together.
For the first couple days after the fire, I didn't see anything coming from the government's end. A lot of it was just community and just out of the goodness of people's hearts. People just doing what they thought was right, using their own boats, their own charter boats from their company, bringing stuff and supplies from the other side. It was just, what do you need? What can we help? How can we help you guys? And it was just like, people were just helping people, you know? I think the government stepped in, I want to say almost like a week after the fire.
Yeah, Lahaina and the people all around us have really stepped in. I knew that everybody was going to help one another, but I didn't know to the extent that it would go. So many of my friends barely making it out, and, you know, I'm blessed to say that a lot of them have, but a lot of them haven't. But this time around, we didn't get anything. No one really knew, and everybody was just kind of holding their ground because, you know, everybody's been here for so long, generations. Some of these houses are generations on generations long. And it's interesting to see that it almost kind of felt that without the National Guard that we were doing better off as a community, you know?
I definitely think that there should have been some warning more than word of mouth. For me personally, a phone call from my brother. That's the warning that I got that there was a fire. And I know a lot of people didn't get a warning from anyone. I met multiple people who, it was a Tuesday afternoon, people were taking a nap, you know? I watched a press conference where he said he didn't regret sounding the siren, which I'm pretty sure everyone knows was just not the best thing to say, but a warning is a warning, you know? If I'm taking a nap, I'm gonna hear a siren, and I'm gonna wake up, and I'm gonna figure out what's going on. It could have been a lot less. A fire's devastating, but it could have been a lot less devastating with lower numbers on the death toll. And I think that could have been accomplished by sounding some sort of an alarm, sending out a nationwide text message. I mean, they sent out a false nuclear missile a few years ago, and they couldn't send out that there's a fire coming this year. I think there were a lot of excuses made, and I'm super grateful to the fire department for doing their job and doing the best that they could. But as far as more higher overseers, I do believe that there could have been more of a warning to the people of Lahaina, especially because I was just warned by my brother, luckily enough. But I know there's a lot of people who didn't get that, so.
Unusual sight captured on camera. Japanese and local astronomers say a Chinese satellite was recently seen beaming down green lasers over the islands. This video captured atop the Subaru telescope on Mauna Kea, operated by the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan. Bryce Moore has the story.
The lasers flash for just a couple seconds. Initially thought to be from a NASA altimeter satellite, the Japanese put out a correction note on Monday saying NASA scientists found a most likely candidate as the ACDL instrument by the Chinese Daki-1 AEMS satellite. I went to a University of Hawaii astronomer who read up on AEMS instruments.
It's a Chinese satellite that is measuring pollutants, among other things. It has many different instruments on it, some kind of topographical mapping, or they're also used for measuring stuff in the Earth's atmosphere, and I think that's what it is. It's an environmental measurement satellite.
I also sat down with the former chief of staff of Marine Forces Pacific. He had some questions.
I'm not sure, this is my opinion, why the Chinese, who are probably some of the most prolific polluters on the planet, would be collecting data on pollutants on this side of the Pacific.
Both experts say this isn't explicitly a spy satellite. It is cataloged and known by governments around the world.
The U.S. has satellites that do the same thing. So in this case, despite all of the flurry, well-deserved flurry about Chinese spy satellites and other devices, this one is just orbiting Earth and has a known orbit.
The footage was taken January 28th, before the recent incident where a Chinese balloon traversed over the mainland U.S. before being shot down off the coast of South Carolina. Which brings the question, how much is the Chinese military seeing?
They can shut down any communication nodes that they want if they believe that I think the public is getting too much information. So, yeah, I think it's more probably military than anything else. Makes sense.
I had to ask,
is this a risk to locals, to Hawaii?
No, it's not a risk to Hawaii or any place else. We have aircraft making these kind of measurements all the time. If you've seen topographical maps with high precision, those are made using sometimes this kind of thing.
It seems to me that those tensions are there. People are a little antsy. And, you know, I think we just need to be a little bit more aware, vigilant.
I reached out to the United States Space Force to see how often Chinese satellites scan Hawaii airspace and if there's been an explanation from China. Officials are working on getting me a response, and we'll bring that to you as soon as we hear back. Bryce Moore, KHON2 News, working for Hawaii.
And that was a social media spotlight. Up next, it's time for a little NFL pick'em, public, private pick'em. Steve Bakken as big government, Sarah Stogner, the unicorn lawyer, she's representing the people, and myself, Jason Spies, is the referee here at the Crude Life.
1270, I'm Steve Bakken, Jason Spies from the Crude Life joining us, as well as Sarah Stogner, the our favorite little oil field attorney down in Texas. And we're going to do something called public-private picks. Now, normally we're going to do this on Wednesday, but we're doing it on Thursday today because today is the kickoff to the NFL schedule. We're going to go head-to-head on our NFL picks.
Thank you very much, Steve Bakken. My name is Jason Spies. I'll be the referee here for the public-private picks as big government takes on the people. Steve Bakken, also known as big government. Let's go Carolina, Atlanta. Sarah Stogner, the unicorn lawyer. Carolina at Atlanta.
Can they both lose? No. I'm a Saints fan. I think it's going to be, who's the home team?
Atlanta.
Atlanta, Dirty Birds, unfortunately.
I'm going to Atlanta.
Right, Dirty Birds. I'm going with Carolina. Carolina's going to upset Adam Thielen's my boy from Mankato, Minnesota. Detroit Lakes, woo, shout out. All right, Houston versus Baltimore. Sarah, Houston versus Baltimore.
At Baltimore.
Okay.
Baltimore.
Steve, Baltimore as well. Let's go with the Cincinnati Bengals at Cleveland. My goodness, week one, we have an Ohio clash. At Cleveland, the Cincinnati Bengals. Sarah?
Bengals, Joe Burrow.
Cincinnati.
By the way, Sarah Stogner is a huge Louisiana State fan, where Ja'Marr Chase and Joe Burrow came from. All right, next, Jacksonville at Indianapolis.
I'm going to go with Indianapolis.
Jacksonville.
I'm going to go with Jacksonville as well. Let's go with the Minnesota Vikings. They're at Minnesota. They're taking on Tampa Bay, a Tom Brady-less and Baker Mayfield-led Oklahoma boy, Tampa Bay. Sarah?
Vikings.
Vikings.
Vikings as well. All right, we got a couple more left here. As I look at the clock, we better get to the Arizona Cardinals at the Washington Commanders under new ownership and a new quarterback and Eric Bieniemy territory. Sarah?
I think I'm going to go with Washington.
I'm going Washington.
As am I, the Washington Commanders. All right, let's go with the Denver Broncos, an affiliate of Town Square Media. The Las Vegas Raiders at the Denver Broncos. Sarah?
Oh, man. I mean, Sean Payton, Russell Wilson. Ugh. You know, I think I'm going to go with our old coach.
I'm going with Denver. My wife's a season ticket holder. I got to go with Denver. I think they're going to be back. And my nephew and my brother-in-law are Raiders fans. So just to stick it to them a little bit, we're going with Denver.
Denver as well. And the last pick, because we're up against the clock, we have the Buffalo Bills at the New York Jets on Monday night with Aaron Rodgers.
I think New York.
Buffalo.
J-E-T-S. Jets. All right. Public-private picks, baby. We'll see you next week.
We'll see how this works out next Wednesday. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270.
As long as you're around me, even when the rain falls, even when the flood starts rising, even when the storm comes.
The Crude Life, the most trusted voice in energy.
Welcome back to the Crude Life Week in Review. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us today. Up next, Edwin Hahn with the Sons of Liberty.
Again, it kind of coming back to this idea of who do we work, worship, serve, and be a slave to? You can choose. You can choose government. You can choose, things like comfort, your employer, education, or you can choose something more divine, something that for millennia, for thousands and thousands of years, humankind has chosen, an unseen, supernatural, super intelligent being that we believe created us. And so in that space, if you don't ground yourself in something greater than yourself, and you worship things that are focused more on self or on comfort or on things that aren't necessarily what we would consider ethical and divine and fair and just, you're gonna have some problems, right? And it looks like slavery, it looks like tyranny, it looks like murder and abuse and all kinds of nasty stuff. We've seen it over the course of history, many different dictators, and we know the pattern. We know the historical pattern of what happens when we give up our autonomy and our authority from our creator and give it into the hands of man or government. It becomes a problem. So any of that, yeah, there is definitely a degradation, right, of where do we get our value system from. And, I put that blame squarely on the church, and we call it quote unquote church leadership. I think you need to be challenging your pastor to speak the truth and to have courage, right? Sacrifice is a necessity in these days. Freedom requires a cost. And so you have to sacrifice, whatever it's your social status, it could be anything, your employment, your little yearly block party that you get invited to in your neighborhood, might have to give up that if you don't get invited because somebody doesn't like what you have to say.
Talk to me about what you've seen, how the value system has either changed or is being used in the media, if you wouldn't mind. Do you understand my question? I hope you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm okay, good. It's such a critical point to bring out, to bring into the public square and to bring into the public awareness that you're being manipulated, and we've been manipulated for quite a while through the media channels, through media systems, and that can be your local newspaper even, and you know, not just the big names like CNN and Fox and all those folks. It's all the way down to the local level. And so as a responsible person living in this land, you need to have discernment and you need to seek out truth. But more so, you just need to be aware of the attack. And once you know yourself and you know your enemy, you're able to overcome. But most folks don't know themselves, and most folks don't even know an adversary that's working through the media, you know, the influence machine. You mentioned the word PSYOP, you know, and that's something to definitely research. What is a PSYOP? What is a PSYACT? What is a target audience? And what has happened in our nation and the media system? How are we being manipulated and influenced and being told what to think, how to think, what to feel? And where is it all originating from? You know, what's the motivation behind it? And what has history shown in terms of patterns, the outcome of this kind of programming? So I think it's very important to bring into the public conversation about PSYOPs, and literally that we've been PSYOPed and we continue to be PSYOPed, and you got to step out of that and study what's being done with our data. Why is our data being harvested? You know, why is AI such a big push right now? And AI, of course, needs to run on a massive amount of big data. And so, you know, these are all valid questions to ask.
Let's talk about that and the local part when we come back. Edwin Hahn is our guest.
It's great if I have one of them, and then if I get an order for 1,000 of them, but I don't have the supply chain set up to satisfy my orders, well, I'm just setting myself up for a very slow die on the vine type of a thing, unless I can keep getting investors that pump money into our human capital and government grants pumping into our human capital. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So two problems I see with it, and you're right. So right there at the show, I could tell that they were pushing to manufacture those. There's several different companies right now based out of California. So Right Speed is a really big one that I see. That guy's, he's brilliant. He's got, they developed trash trucks a while back that were using, they used a gas turbine engine as a generator so they could have a range extension device and they could charge batteries off of it. And then if they came back to the home dock, they could charge that way. I think it's a good concept, but if you move enough trash trucks, so at one point in time, several California provinces and counties were saying that they wanted to ban, because of trash trucks and like FedEx and UPS or the mail delivery trucks, they wanted to, maybe ban's not the word, they just wanted to push them out to where they would have these route trucks or route vehicles would be all electric. But I think that you and I have already discussed this, Jason. The infrastructure necessary to charge one of these trucks is there, and maybe even 10 in a county. When you start charging 50 and 100 delivery trucks and trash trucks, it would be damaging to the infrastructure. And California's already pushed it really hard with the other EV vehicles. So that's one big problem. The other big thing I see, and this might be for future discussion, do you know that there's not trained technicians for these vehicles yet? I was an instructor. I worked at a junior college for 8 years to train it to individuals to be diesel technicians. That you've got to have people go through training programs. We don't have that yet. I've talked with Kenley kind of extensively about a training program for EV heavy duty class 5 through 8 trucks. We don't have trained or skilled technicians in that field yet. Kenworth, Peterbilt, Freightliner, they've all worked hard to get skilled technicians within dealerships to work on some of their hybrid vehicles and electric class 5 vehicles. It's not there. We're struggling to have trained technicians in just the class 8 you know, ICE engine industry, the conventional trucks. I think that what we'll see is we could have these developed and emerge and they're there and available. But the first time they break down, pretty soon we'll have a bone heap if we don't have technicians there and infrastructure in that regard to maintain them. So definitely some issues there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there really is. So what is your bottom line when it comes to the supply chain? I mean, we're talking about there's might be some, you know, favoritism or picking and choosing of where the rare earth minerals are going. We have just the fact of merging and acquisitions and different still people trying to streamline after COVID, if you will. There's a myriad of examples for issues and that sort of thing. What's kind of the takeaway from the supply chain issue from where you are trying to put together an electric hybrid of a semi-engine and a gas combustion engine and a EV battery type of a system?
Yeah, what we're seeing right now is that so Panasonic's large producer of the lithium iron phosphate batteries and lithium ion batteries. So what they're pushing towards is they want to go towards manufacturers like Tesla. And then some of the other larger manufacturers that are, some of them are utilizing their own battery technology, which is not built in-house. The truth is, Jason, most of it comes from China. They're probably 15 years ahead of us on the electric vehicle spectrum because they've used EVs for so long in different larger cities in China. They've got a lot of manufacturers there. They pushed that agenda for a lot longer than we have. So the truth is a lot of it's coming out of there. You know, I talked with Eaton and Allison reps both on their e-axles for class 5 through class 8 trucks. And they want to supply to the larger manufacturers in North America, the larger EV truck manufacturers. So like Freightliner, Kenworth, if you look at the specs on all of their hybrid and battery electric trucks, they are all using Eaton axles or Allison axles. Some of Rockwell makes some. But just between me and you, I think a lot of the technology has come from different companies in China, and there's a lot of mixing. Allison at one point said they're making axles for a company in China, and I almost wondered if it was the other way around where, you know, they were kind of going back and forth with parts. But it definitely looks like they're favoring a lot of these larger vehicle manufacturers. That's where we're seeing all the batteries and controllers and components going into because they have high production numbers. So then if you've got smaller companies like myself or other smaller companies there, it's just hard. It's harder to get some of the components unless we source them. You know, they're not sourced domestically then they've got to be sourced somewhere else and brought in they've got to be imported in from somewhere else.
To listen to the full-length interview with Edwin Hahn with Sons of Liberty or to check out other exclusive interviews, visit thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. Up next, Project Evolution with Levi Perkins. That's right, we take a semi from an engine, an EV battery from an electric car, hybrid them together. That brings us Project Evolution Hybrid. Welcome back to the Crude Life Week in Review. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us today. Up next, broadcast your podcast with the Oil and Whiskey Podcast.
For you, who would win in a fight, the Miata fans or the Florida Georgia Line fans?
It never comes to fisticuffs. That's some high-pitched screaming and yelling. There's a chest
which
bump.
Which quickly turns into the Miata guys diffusing the situation and finding an alternate method of...
They become friends at the end.
Yeah. some sort of agreement of like, oh, we can respect your music taste. We don't necessarily agree with them, but
I tell you, I bet you there's some Miata drivers that rock out to some Florida Georgia Line. Maybe not racing Miata enthusiasts, but just a guy that likes
that owns a Miata.
Oh, spirited driving on the weekends. The British Racing Green.
I don't know. I don't know if there's a lot of bro country in that.
I think Florida Georgia Line crosses US all boundaries. It's just a. It's just music.
Okay. You ask all your friends. I'll ask mine. We'll see.
We'll get together.
This crowd, yeah.
So George Poteet is a name that if you've been in this industry long enough, he comes up in just about every circle, every builder, racing, show cars, hot rods, muscle cars, everything. We've had the pleasure of getting to know him quite well over the last 5 or 6 years. Great guy. The stories he has are endless. He's the records that he holds with Land Speed Racing. And I mean, I saw an interesting stat today too. We'll talk about it. There's 12 men have been on the moon, and there's been exactly 12 men drive over 400 miles an hour. It's pretty crazy. But George also has been over 400 miles an hour more than all of the other guys combined, I think, right?
He's the world's fastest.
World's fastest piston-powered, engine-driven man. Yeah, piston-powered, engine-driven, wheel-driven, something like that. Fast as shit. Then the cars that he has built and the shops that he has, I mean, put on the map because of those, it's endless. There's always a story about it. You know, George here, George there, something. And the things he does behind the scenes that nobody ever even knows about makes him even a greater man and a legend. I don't use the word legend loosely, and I think we can all agree that he is a legend.
100%. Yeah. Done some absolutely incredible things for this entire industry. And you know, there's nobody else I can even think of to put in the same ballpark as what he's done for the car industry, for the hot rod industry. Phenomenal guy. Been involved in an insane number of the coolest of the cool projects. All aspects of it, traditional hot rods, show cars, muscle cars, pro touring stuff, land speed stuff, just road tour cars.
An honest guy. And yep. He'll tell you if something's ugly or not.
Yep.
George, take us back to the beginning where this, where your love of cars and kind of the history of how all this got started.
I don't know if I remember that far back or not. I was raised in the country from in Northeast Mississippi, where you had to work on cars if you wanted to have one. I was raised riding horses and bicycles and tractors, and we had an old 53 Dodge. It had to be worked on regularly to keep it running, get my mother to work. So in 1962, 63, when I really started driving. I'm born in 48, so I'm 15 years old in 63. But I was driving tractors and equipment when I was probably 12 years old. But I learned to deal with cars from a necessity, not as a choice.
Didn't have any choice but to get it running if you had to get someplace, I guess. So you're working on cars, you're doing that. What was your first job?
My first job? I guess feeding hogs and cows. We had a small farm that we raised pigs and cows on, and I guess the first job was working on a farm. I guess my real first commercial job was I worked in a newspaper office around a cut and dye press, where you cut the cardboard, it goes under the collars or shirts, but that was a summer job. The first real job I had was at Pennsylvania Tire and Rubber Company in Tupelo, building tires.
What year was that?
That would have been 1966.
But they had probably a little different work standards and a little different OSHA involvement back in 66 at the tire plant than they do now.
Well, it was, I was 18 years old.
The love for cars, George, did that start? Was there something that triggered you on that old Dodge pickup truck, or when did that set in?
Well, probably the biggest influence I had on me was Hot Rod Magazine. And of course, back then you had the beach movies going on, and there were hot rods in all of them. The muscle cars really weren't that big back then from where I came from. I never saw a Hemi engine in a car until probably 1970. The people where I came from didn't have the money to buy things like that. But we got Hot Rod Magazine and library of the school. And then, of course, you could, watch Sandra Dee and Elvis and everybody on the movie screen. It's usually some sort of hot rod there. But that's really, what started the big craze for me and wanting a hot rod. And I guess the biggest influence would have been American Graffiti and a 32 Ford. Everybody wanted a 32 Ford after that movie. And when I was growing up, 14 years old, there was a guy that father owned a gas station there in Mantachie where I was raised. It, I don't know, 32.5 went a coupe. I don't know, garage with a dirt floor on it. And I'd go by there after school in the afternoon and watch him work on that thing. And I never saw it move under its own power, though, in 3 years.
Sounds like one of my projects.
Yeah. But we watched movies and magazines mainly was the biggest influence we had. And, Hot Rod Magazine was the biggest influence I ever had. Cars, including the Bonneville Racing. You read about it, NASCAR, Bonneville, drag racing. I grew up even before the lights came into drag racing. They flagged cars with checkered flags. So when I first started being able to go to a drag strip, and we had a small drag strip close to where I live. I never attended a NASCAR race probably until I was 30 years old. I never had the money to go to one. But we read about them. You didn't watch a lot of TV about them back then. Nothing was covered under it unless it wasn't under the Wide World of Sports. You didn't see it on television. But the biggest thing, was Hot Rod Magazine, which I still look at today.
And that was Broadcast Your Podcast, the Oil and Whiskey Podcast. Links and information available at thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. That's going to do it this week for the Crude Life Week in Review. I'd like to thank Joe Sinnott with Whitting partner Sarah Stogner, the Unicorn Lawyer, America's Energy Influencer, as well as Edwin Hahn from the Sons of Liberty, Curtis Junt, Pipeline Engineer, Levi Perkins with Evolution Hybrid, and all the guests from today's program. We'll be back next week at this time on this radio station. From the staff at the Crude Life Week in Review, my name is Jason Spies, asking each and every one of you to remember all energy has a purpose, and we are all energy. Make it a fantastic week.